this part. All right, there is an announcement here. The bill that we're, this is a bill, House File 306 from Representative Greiling will, a bill for an act relating to education, providing for youth mental health screening and suicide prevention, will be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. All right. And today, the business of today is House File 196, Representative Greiling's bill. Representative Greiling, you'd like to come to the podium and then move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move House File 196.
Okay, House File 196 has been moved. Are there any, do you have an author's amendment you'd like
to
offer?
Madam Chair, I do. And members have it in their packets. It is Amendment A6. And I also have an oral amendment to it, which I will give you first, if that's all right, Madam Chair.
That would be fine, Representative.
Okay, on page 2, line 18. So it would be 2.18. It says incentive payments to providers that place individuals in jobs that allow them to, and then after to, but before become, if people could insert these words, leave SSI and SSDI dependency and. So now it reads, shall develop rules to implement incentive payments to providers that place individuals in jobs that allow them to leave SSI and SSDI dependency and become economically self-sufficient. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to incorporate that oral amendment into Amendment A6.
Okay, so we have that incorporated in the amendment, and then would you like to speak to the amendment, Representative Greiling?
I would. Madam Chair, the page 1 of the amendment, section 8, is a deleting the section that you have in the bill and substituting the one that's here, and we will hear more about that when I present the bill. On page 2, the first section there is some changed language for the section that deals with having a task force to look into people with mental illness who have been wounded or shot. And so we have some change language there. It deletes chief judge and puts in the Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee. And just a heads up for any members in the audience who might be concerned about this change, we're actually working on yet another change. The justices from the 4th Judicial District are meeting in a couple weeks to give us even a better home for that. But for now, this will be a better placeholder than the chief judge because that person would have a conflict by being given this assignment. And then the rest of that section is parallel language with domestic violence legislation. And then the incentive payments down below are all new to the bill, but they go along with the topic that we heard about last week, extended employment, and they are to make sure that there are financial incentives for actually finding people good jobs with benefits. And because it's to all of our advantages to have the programs that we're funding as taxpayers to make sure that people get jobs, to make sure they do get jobs, and then they are no longer on SSI and SSDI, but paying taxes, and it helps them and us. So, Madam Chair, that's the amendment.
Are there any questions for Representative Greiling on the amendment? Representative Tinkelstedt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling, I see on today's agenda that this bill is marked for discussion only, and so I think, Madam Chair, that we're not going to be voting on it today. Maybe you could respond, and then I have a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tinkelstedt, that is correct. And in fact, before I present the bill, I'm going to talk about the process for this, but maybe your follow-up question will get to it.
Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling. So I assume we're going to incorporate this amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like, and then I'm wondering, at the point that we see this bill again to vote on it, if these changes will be engrossed in the next version so we can look at it all in one bill scenario.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tingelstad, this bill is going to, it's my understanding, and I wish the chair had her voice today, but it's my understanding, and having talked with the chair and others, that this bill will actually stay in this committee, but we are amending it to get it in the shape that we want so we can forward these amendments to the authors of the individual bills. There are something like 18 individual bills that are parceling out this big bill, and they are heading off to the other topic committees, including the finance committees. This is not a finance committee, and we need these provisions to be funded, so we need to send them to the finance committees. And so that's where they're going. And some of them are go to policy committees first. But since we already know we want these changes made, we thought it would be easier to say the mental health division made these changes, and then each author that these apply to their section of the bill can make them also at the beginning of their committee stop, and then they will be engrossed at that point.
Representative Walker.
Representative Tingelstad and Representative Greiling, you did an excellent job. One of the things that we found with this particular bill, there's so many different stops. We wanted to make as much time savings as possible, and that's why the bill is being split up. However, it's this committee's responsibility to hear the entire bill. So we're going to hear the entire bill over a two-day period. We'll be finishing the discussion next week. And I don't want members to see the long list of testifiers and think you don't have time to ask questions. We have built in plenty of time to ask questions. Feel free to express your concerns as we move along today. And we're going to try to get as much information. It's a difficult process, but we're going to get through it.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Walker. So just to clarify then, it sounds like after a couple of hearings that we would actually be taking a vote at that point, or would you be still laying the bill over for future consideration later on?
Chair Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tingelstad, I believe we're going to be laying it over for further consideration. One of the things that we want to do is keep up with the different pieces of the bill as it travels through the different committees and come back with updates here. The committee won't be over after we get done with Representative Greiling's bill. We do have some other bills that we have to take up for consideration. So we'll be following this bill, and it's still undetermined if we're going to have some policy pieces that we have to address by the end of the process.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, Representative Greiling, you may speak to your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Representative Tingle said that was helpful, I think, because I was going to give a preview, but your questions helped focus exactly what's happened, and we got to verify that from the chair, is my understanding. So, and I think it will be important for all of us in this room, including committee members, to make sure we keep track of this bill as it goes through the various funding committees.
Excuse me, Representative Greiling. I have made my first protocol error. We need to vote on the amendment.
Oh.
Okay. If there are no further questions on the amendment, all those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, the amendment stands approved, and now you may speak to your bill.
Very good. I didn't notice it either, so...
Luckily, I have help.
Yes, we all have to have help. It would behoove us all to pay attention to these parts of this bill, and then I hope this committee, and I think Representative Walker is committed to doing that, we'll keep track of the total package, because we believe that this topic will be getting some money this year, and we have to look at the whole package and make sure it's balanced. So I'm pleased that we have this committee and to be on it. I would like to thank for this House File 196 the Mental Health Legislative Network, who are the people who worked on this bill. I met with them or asked them a few months ago to come up with a bill that would be comprehensive. We have a lot of little bills around here addressing the mental health system or bigger bills, but no alternatives to them. The governor has a bill that he had last year, and I had some questions about the funding sources. But I liked what he had in his bill. This bill and the governor's bill, which we'll hear later, have a lot of common parts, but then there's also more things in here that the, his bill still leaves holes on. So I think we can, the bills will work nicely together, I'm told. Anyway, the network worked on this bill, and they will be here to testify as well. But to present the bill, children and adults with mental illness in Minnesota who do not receive treatment, medications, or community supports that they need end up dropping out of school or work, alienating their families, going into out-of-home placement, or roaming the streets and ending up in juvenile corrections or the criminal justice system, which, of course, costs money, too. House File 196 recognizes there is no silver bullet to shore up the mental health system or to ensure access to all. It recognizes we must interject money in various ways into quality systems and at different stages. Article 1, if you're following through in the bill, is the section on criminal justice. And what we're trying to do here is identify people with mental illness early, provide treatment and support so they do not go back to the criminal justice system. Section 1, it requires a mental health assessment of inmates who are in administrative segregation. And since this bill is also being heard next week, Representative Kamar, last week you had a question on offenders who are in isolation and then they are let right out when their time is up without being sure that they're safe. And so the network is working on an amendment next week that will be added into that section that will address your concern. Section 2 recognizes that when people with a mental illness leave jail or prison, they need some type of health insurance to cover the cost of their medications and treatment, creating the opportunity for people to leave a correctional facility to be eligible for general assistance medical care for 3 months while they complete their paperwork for other programs and obtain jobs will help stop the revolving door for their safety as well as the public safety. Section 3 requires a mental health assessment for defenders convicted of misdemeanors. We already require this for chemical dependency. This would be language to also require a mental health assessment, and it's also a condition of a stayed sentence. This would be a way, again, for prevention. Section 5 requires a validated mental health screening tool to be used at intake in the jails. And there are free screens that are available, and they take under 4 minutes to administer. Section 6 creates a demonstration project to conduct discharge planning for people with mental illness, traumatic brain injury, chemical dependency, and a history of homelessness who are in our jails. Right now, we do a better job with people coming out of prison than we do coming out of jails. And actually, we could help keep them out of prison if we would not do such a poor job when they come out of jail. Section 7 contains the appropriations that include the increased funding for the things in this section, and including the mental health courts. Right now, when people talk about the problem-solving courts, they usually mean the drug courts. We only have a couple mental health courts in Minnesota. They're both in the metro area, but we need them all around the state, including greater Minnesota. Article 2 is on children's mental health, and it focuses on what needs to be done in this system, and it does restore some funding for the children's mental health collaboratives, where the federal government has done us no favors, and they're actually cutting funding in the area of mental health and a big whack in children's mental health. They will have lost nearly 80% of their federal dollars this year. Section 2 recognizes that most children going into out-of-home placement do so because of their behaviors. We think of it as abuse and neglect, but it's usually their behaviors, their mental illness. And so foster care providers who do the out-of-home placement really need to be given some help so they can know who they're dealing with and how to work with them. That's required in this, or offered in this bill. Section 3 funds a program for at-risk children that are looking like they're headed straight for prison. It's already in Ramsey County. It's called the ACE program, All Children Excel. And this would keep that program going and also offer it in other counties around the state. On page 10, section 4, it would greatly increase funding for the children's therapeutic support services and supports, which are things like therapy, provider travel, and such. Section 5 would fund the well-established and researched Columbia Teen Screen. This program is free, but schools, if they're going to administer it to teenagers who may be depressed, but their families and they do not know it, need to have the funding to carry it out. And parents, I want to make clear, would have the option to opt in for this. You know, we have the student survey where parents have to opt out. This is a much higher threshold. They have to opt in, and the students themselves have to agree to participate as well. Section 6 would create a workforce to look at the components of wraparound services and make sure that Minnesota has included what it can in its Medicaid plan so we could get as much money from the federal government as possible. Even though it's shrinking, we want every dime. Section 7 is for trauma-focused services to children. And this is an effective early intervention program. Stress can be a precipitating factor for mental illness, as I guess Representative Wardlow is not here today, but he always mentions the veterans. And the same thing for children in trauma. Section 8 creates funding for respite care for families who have a child with mental illness to prevent out-of-home placements. It's kind of like the TAFRA program where people need to have some help to keep their kids in the homes, and if they have a little break, they can work on that more. Mm-hmm. Section 9 are the appropriations for this section. Article 3 is the catch-all section, and Section 1 recognizes that many young people in college develop a mental illness, and for that reason they should have health insurance. And this language was actually modeled after the state of Massachusetts. We've been looking to them for other things in health care. They have also been ahead of us on this. Section 2 modifies the case manager statute and adds that being in a jail or prison or having used crisis services should be viewed the same as someone who has been hospitalized or ended up in a treatment facility. Again, this whole premise of this bill, the earlier you treat, the more effective to help out and the cheaper. Section 3 allows professionals in bordering states, this is, I think, a provision for like Fargo-Moorhead, to be considered an examiner under the Commitment Act. We already allow contracts with facilities in border states, but we don't have contracts for their professionals. And if somebody, you know, ends up in on the other side of the state line, this just facilitates the professionals working together. Section 5 provides grant funds for culturally specific organizations so that they can provide culturally support services and create a bridge between their communities and mental health providers. There's a lot of concern about children being identified with a mental illness when they don't have one. And if you don't have culturally competent providers, then that exacerbates that problem. When the Education Committee was in North Minneapolis last week, we heard testimony from a child psychiatrist from North Point, and he said that children, if they don't have culturally competent identifiers, can be overdiagnosed. He also said, though, that they can be underdiagnosed. And if they aren't diagnosed because people don't know their culture, or you don't have a child psychiatrist, you just have a general practitioner, then they suffer also. And then there's also the problem of access to care for people of other cultures. There aren't as many providers that can competently provide care. Section 5 provides grant funds for I already read that one. That was the one I was on. Section 6 creates a crisis intervention team state council to encourage the crisis intervention training that's provided to police officers and other law enforcement personnel. And this is very good training that's the best out there in the country, and it helps with the officers being safe as well as better safety for the persons with mental illness crises that they're trying to deal with. Section 7 creates a pilot project to look at the impact that mental illness in a child can have on the parent's ability to obtain and retain work under the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Section 8 creates a mental health fatality review team. This is the section that we amended earlier. And it would review the deaths of individuals with mental illness to determine if there are any practices that should be changed to prevent that death in the future. It's parallel language, as I said, to the domestic violence statute, and people with mental illness and people involved in domestic violence are often the same people. Section 9 looks to ways to find budget-neutral ways to make sure that Medicaid can cover evidence-based practices. Section 10 provides, Representative Paymar's looking stern, he and I have discussions about that because this area is domestic violence and I work in mental health and we have words on that, but I'm right. Section 10 provides for special employment projects that target young people with mental illness transitioning from school to work and to adults with mental illness who are in the commitment court or mental health court. You know, if they get into trouble, we want them to have jobs so they don't reoffend. And young people, you know, get taken care of well in the schools, but then they need to not have gaps in service so they don't get into trouble when they're done with school. They need work as well. Section 11 funds video conferencing. This is, you know, more for the greater Minnesota areas, but actually could be used in other areas as well, just so community and state agencies and providers can communicate without having to travel, which is, can be a big cost expense in some of our greater Minnesota areas. Section 12 funds a demonstration project for people who have a dual diagnosis of mental illness and chemical dependency, which is a huge gap. People that provide services for mental illness want the chemical dependency problem to be taken care of before they take them and vice versa, and then the people have nowhere to go. Section 13 contains the appropriation for extended employment, serious mental illness that we heard about last week, and also funding for training clinical supervisors, suicide prevention programs in colleges, Bridges Housing, another program we heard about last week, and the other items in this article. I am going to have, we had an amendment on that section earlier. That was where the incentive payments went in. And then finally, Article 4 is on mental health funding, and this is to shore up our community mental health providers so that there is capacity. You know, we have good programs in our state, but often the waiting lists are so huge that people can't get into them, and it's especially true of children's services. Section 1 includes children's therapeutic services and supports under programs that receive inflationary increases. Section 2 adds family psychoeducation as a service that's provided under adult rehabilitation mental health services. Right now, if providers work with families, they do that on their own time and own dime and own time. And that's a disincentive then for them to do that when we really know that research shows it's very helpful if they find the time to do that. If they could be paid for it, they would for sure find the time. Section 3 increases funding for diagnostic assessments. Section 4 clarifies that the armed services, that's the adult rehabilitation mental health services, also include coordination and case management, collateral contacts, and family psychoeducation. So again, it's for the coordination that they really have to do, especially the child psychiatrists say that they really have to spend a lot of time working with the schools and others, and if they don't, they can't provide a very complete picture, but yet they don't get paid for any of that. Section 5 allows payment for mental health professionals who have completed all the requirements except for supervised experience and clinical supervision. This is to kind of stretch out the shortage of professionals. Section 6 has medical assistance providing reimbursement for travel. Section 7 adds reimbursement for the originating facility fee and the cost of the telemedicine, the broadband. Section 8 adds peer-to-peer support services as a covered service under medical assistance. Section 9 adds intensive mental health outpatient treatment as a benefit. That would be the ACT, the Assertive Community Treatment Teams. Section 10, we're getting done here, adds case management as a benefit. Section 11 adds the collateral contacts from up above as a benefit. Section 12 tries to increase the rate that providers get for providing services to people who are on Medicare and medical assistance. Section 13 is again for the family psychoeducation under children's services. Section 14 it adds those same things as a covered service. Section 15 increases payment assessments for diagnostic assessments. All these are kind of repetitive with the legal language where amendments are needed. Section 16 and 17 protect mental health services when payments to managed care plans are reduced. We already do this for nursing homes and, oops, I have another page here, we're not almost done, for nursing homes and some other disabilities. This would add in mental health services. Section 18 increases reimbursement payments to the mental health professionals. Section 19 adds providers of skills training, psychotherapy, and diagnostic assessments for a rate increase. Section 20 expands the model mental health benefit set that people on medical assistance get, but people on general assistance medical care do not get. Section 22 does the same for people on Minnesota care. We have this gap where certain things are required for people on medical assistance, but not the other two public programs. Skipping back to Section 21, it adds the food stamp eligibility for people who are on the CADI waiver, which means they're not in institutions or group homes. Section 20, out on their own, and so they, but they still should qualify for the food stamp program. Section 23 excludes co-payments under Minnesota care. People often don't want to take their medicines anyway and wonder why they need to take them, and then if you make them pay for them as well, they're really not going to take them. Section 20, Bruce, and Representative Anderson is smiling with knowledge about that statement. Section 24 is just more language related to Section 22. Section 25 deletes the four-month waiting period for Minnesota care and allows more children on Minnesota care program if they have poor mental health coverage. Again, if a person has mental illness and you give them a four-month waiting period, a lot can happen in 4 months. Section 26 excludes mental health benefits from rate reduction. Section 27 includes the Children's Therapeutic Support Services and the ARM services in the rate increases. And this one is finally, it funds the three programs, crisis service, mental health tracking system, and suicide prevention. So, Madam Chair, I think we ended right on time.
You did that very efficiently, Representative Greiling. But before I take ask for questions, I think I should offer Representative Paymar the chance to defend his reputation. not necessary. All right.
Madam Chair, he's a smart man.
are there questions for Representative Greiling at this point? Yes, Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. Nice overview of bill summary. I feel like we should all take a breath after you're talking so fast. I was trying to page through the bill. I know when you initially talked about the bill, you talked a little bit about the background over the last year or so, and I'm just so amazed how much is in here and the thorough discussions. Can you give us any kind of indication, like the number of people hours over the last year to get to a point where something is this comprehensive?
Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair, Representative Tingelstad, you have segued right into our next testifier, and so could I invite Sue Abderholden to come up. And I will just say that Sue Abderholden is the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, but she's also this year's Chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. It rotates between the Mental Health Association and the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And so the Mental Health Association chaired it last session. This session it's NAMI Minnesota, and it rotates back and forth like that, being the biggest players in the mental health numbers of people that are in their organization. And as far as, I don't know, Madam Chair, if you want to have other questions or you want to go right into Sue Abderholden's testimony.
I'll just ask members, are there any pressing questions that you feel you need to have addressed now, or is everyone comfortable with going ahead with the testimony? Seeing no hands, yes, let's continue with the testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the division, my name is Sue Abderholden, and I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. NAMI is a statewide organization that provides education, support, and advocacy to children and adults with mental illness. The Mental Health Legislative Network is a coalition of over 20 organizations working together to advocate for a mental health system that is of high quality, that is accessible, and that has stable funding. And in reference to your question, the answer would be many hours. A few weeks ago, you received this blue book. I hope you remember it. It was put together by the network to provide each of you with information about mental illness and with ideas on how to improve the mental health system. About 1 in 5 adults are affected by mental illness and 1 in 10 children. Despite research that demonstrates that treatment works, despite the fact that recovery and resiliency is possible, too many children and adults do not have access to the treatment and supports that enable them to live successful lives. What this bill attempts to do is to support early intervention, make available health care and treatment, strengthen the infrastructure of our mental health system, ensure access to providers, and provide those services that support children and adults in the community. We thank Representative Greiling for authoring this bill and many of you who have signed on to the bill. And for those of you who haven't, it's not too late. Many people today will testify to the importance of a number of the provisions and next week as well. But I want to take just a few minutes to highlight a couple of them. Children's Mental Health Collaboratives have produced positive results for over 10 years. The collaboratives provide an interagency approach, bringing together social services, schools, public health, mental health, and corrections to address the complex needs of children with mental illness. The collaboratives maximize resources and avoid duplication. There are 14 children's mental health collaboratives and 30 integrated collaboratives where you have the family and children's mental health ones together. You have a chart in your folder. You did receive a blue folder today with information that outlines the services that are provided by the collaboratives. As Representative Greiling stated, due to federal funding changes, they're going to lose close to 80% of their funding. These cuts threaten the very foundation of the collaboratives and the well-being of many children. The ACE program, which is currently operating in Ramsey County, intervenes very early with children under the age of 10 who are at high risk of ending up in the criminal justice and mental health systems. Through many years of research and evaluation, they are able to demonstrate huge cost savings. Their money runs out at the end of the year, and this is a program that should continue to operate not only in Ramsey County, but other counties as well. New Mexico thinks it's such a great idea, they're going to implement it in every county in their state. And again, you have a handout in your folder on its effectiveness. Children go into out-of-home placement for many reasons. But in 2005, about 1,500 children were placed in foster care due to alleged physical abuse, around 4,800 for alleged neglect, and over 5,000 for their behaviors. The number one reason that children are placed outside of the home was due to their behavior. And how equipped are foster parents to handle these challenging behaviors? Foster parents receive initial training before they are licensed, and then they must receive 12 hours every year of continuing education. None of that training has to be specifically related to mental illness. They learn about team building, abuse and neglect, cultural issues, attachment, but really nothing about mental illness. I happen to have a foster care license, so I know what's required and what is offered to us as foster parents, and I can tell you that we need more. Some of you may remember a few years ago, the Minnesota legislature passed the first of its kind law in the country requiring teachers to receive training on the early warning signs of mental illness in children and adolescents. Just yesterday, the special education director of a northern district stated at a meeting that this law has been extremely successful and that these kids are far more understood than ever before. Well, shouldn't foster parents be armed with that same important information? As you know, we have yet to pass a national mental health parity law, although it will be done this year. With over 50% of Minnesotans covered by a self-insured plan, that means that many do not benefit from Minnesota's mental health parity law and that many children have extremely poor coverage for their mental illness. The provision in this bill that would expand Minnesota care to children with limited coverage would be a godsend to families who struggle to obtain the care that their children need. Many families, including my own, rack up huge debt in order to make sure our children get the treatment they need to be successful at home, at school, and in the community. Crisis services have become a critical part of our mental health system. If we were really to fund them 24/7, provide them base funding so that they aren't operating solely on what they can bill for, they could provide a true alternative to police response, an alternative to long waits in the emergency rooms, and provide the necessary follow-up when there is a mental health crisis. We need to fund crisis services like we do fire departments. We pay for them to be there, so if we need them, not just when we use them. They need to become viewed as an important resource for emergencies. Sometimes, and all too frequently, people with mental illness end up in the criminal justice system. In this bill, we have tried to identify people early by requiring a mental health screen, then divert them to treatment instead of incarceration, and finally try to make sure that if they do end up in jail or prison, that it's their last time, not one of many times. Discharge planning is the key to ending the revolving door into the criminal justice system. Lastly, I just want to say that the time to invest in the lives of children and adults with mental illness and their families has come. The time to invest in our mental health system has come. We have waited too long. We have seen too many lives be lost. I received an email yesterday from Leanne from Northern Minnesota who wrote, "The treatment I have received has helped me tremendously. A few years ago, I was not even able to work. Now I work full-time as an executive assistant to 4 real estate brokers, and I love my job. I love my life. I narrowly escaped from losing it. I am grateful for that and want to help others get quality treatment so that they, too, can live happy and productive lives. Please join with Leanne to help others. The time is now." Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden. Are there questions? Comments? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Aberholden, how many people are you aware of that are on, as you call it, the revolving door of mental illness people going into the juvenile justice or even regular justice system and then coming back out and going back in? Do you have any kind of statistics?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, NAMI Minnesota did a survey of the jails last year. And what they tell us is that, and while they don't have, because they don't all use a screening tool, that they believe that about over 60% of the people that they see in jails are people who have a mental illness, and that many of them they know on a first-name basis.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Do you have any numbers of, and maybe Representative Paymar would know this, as to how many people are incarcerated every year? I'm just looking at, you're saying 60%, looking at a number of people that get incarcerated, kind of getting an idea of what we're looking at for people who would enter into the system like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, my understanding from the Department of Corrections is that it's around 25% of the population has a mental illness, serious mental illness.
Okay, thank
any
you.
Further questions, comments? Okay, thank you for your testimony. And Representative Greiling, would you like to introduce the next testifier, or should I just call
Suzette? Why don't you call them?
Suzette Scheel. And if you have the list of testifiers, if you could be prepared as your name is coming up, that would be helpful. Thank you. Yes, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Suzette Sheely, and thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you today about respite care for families. I'm a parent of 3 children. I have 2 children with special needs. My sons first received a mental health diagnosis when they were around 3. They are now 17 and 15. Over the past 14 years, I have been thrown into a world of medical appointments, play therapy, psychiatric appointments, speech therapy, occupational therapy, behavior analysts, and receiving services from both the county and the school system. I also hold a full-time job. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and I am a single parent. I am exhausted, and I basically have been grounded to my home. My sons need ongoing supervision, support, and care. Even though they are teenagers, they can't be left at home alone with their sister, so I can just run a quick trip to the grocery store. I can't go to Walgreens just to pick up their prescriptions. Whenever I need to run an errand, I have to pack up the kids to go with me. Last fall, when my oldest son fell around 10 p.m. and he needed to go to the emergency room to get stitches, I had to wake up my other children to take him to the emergency room. Can you imagine taking 3 children to the emergency room at 10 o'clock at night and they have special needs? My life is full of juggling schedules, making sure I get home from work before the school bus arrives, spending the evening teaching my son daily living skills, doing homework, and trying somehow just to hold it all together. I don't get a break. I don't have a life for myself. The children's dad lives out of state, and my parents are aging. I searched for several years to find a qualified respite facility. I finally found one. The boys went for a weekend, and it was great. I called to schedule another weekend, and the facility had closed. I again inquired to find a new respite facility for my children, and I found that there is a multi-year waiting list for children to receive respite care. I need a break. I need some time for myself. After all, everyone says I should take care of myself first. But how do I do that without respite care? I know in talking with other families who have children with mental illness that sometimes they get so worn down, so tired, that they're forced to look at out-of-home placement options. Yet out-of-home placements are so expensive, and they are so hard on the families. If you provided just a little bit of respite care, I believe that many out-of-home placements could be prevented. I'm asking you today to support funding for respite care for families like myself that are exhausted from the demands that are placed on us in raising children with special needs. Respite care will allow us to take care of ourselves, to recharge our own batteries, so that we can meet the demands of our daily life and to take care of our children. Respite care allows families to pay much-needed attention to the other children in the home and to their spouses. Respite care simply is a good investment for everyone.
Thank you for your testimony. It's very compelling. Are there questions for Ms. Shealy? Well, I'll just say that as a mom, I appreciate, I mean, in a normal circumstance, I think moms feel a need for respite care. So with the extreme of your circumstances, I identify. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, my wife used to say, she would always say she wishes she had another wife to help her out.
Well, thank you for that comment. Representative McFarland?
Thank you for sharing. Chair, first.
Yes.
Thank you for your testimony. I'd like to know, what is it going to look like 5 years from now? What kind of services will be available for your children when they become adults?
Well, we hope that through school services and support that we can transition the boys successfully to be independent. You know, my goal is, like every other parent, that they'll be emancipated from my home and living somewhat independent, whether that's in a group home or another option that's available. So I really don't know what 5 years is going to look like. It depends, you know, a lot. They're becoming adults and how they take care of themselves and if they stay in treatment for their mental illness.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Okay. If not, thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Andrea Ayers. If you'd come to the microphone and identify yourself for the record, please. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Ayers. I work for Family and Children's Service. We're a private nonprofit based in the metro area, and we're also a member of the Mental Health Legislative Network. I'm here to discuss two pieces of the bill that are running separately. One is the Columbia Teen Screen, and the other is the Children's Mental Health and MFIT Pilot Project. I'm addressing both of those because they're both screening projects. The first one is the Columbia Teen Screen, and what that portion of the bill would be to appropriate money to either schools or collaboratives to implement the Columbia Teen Screen. It's a national screening program primarily focused on teenagers. About age 11 is the lowest that we would go. It's implemented in schools, oftentimes other places, but primarily in schools. And it is an option, a voluntary option. Parents have to opt into it. Children have to agree to participate in it. And they are screened looking for things like depression, symptoms of depression, symptoms of anxiety, symptoms of substance abuse problems. The reason they focus on those three areas is because those three areas are rather common in the teenage community. They're very treatable if caught in the teenage community, and if untreated, often lead to suicidal ideation or suicide attempts. So this is an opportunity for the schools or collaboratives to offer this to parents and their children to screen these kids and catch these symptoms long before we're talking about suicidal thoughts or, worse yet, a suicide attempt. Once again, it's voluntary. The parents have to opt in. The way it works, it's kind of a two-step process. The kids fill out, answer some questions. It's usually on the computer. The questions are focused on symptoms of anxiety, substance abuse, depression. If a red flag goes up, if they answer too many questions, yes, they are then referred to a mental health professional who would do an interview with them. If the mental health professional sees the red flags and deems that there's a problem, they will then talk to the parents and offer them the opportunity to have a referral for a full mental health evaluation. Again, completely voluntary. The parents and the children have to agree to participate. That's the first program. Another portion of the bill is a pilot project that would look at children that are participating in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. That's our state's welfare program.
Ms. Ayers, could you just hold a minute, Representative Walker? Okay, sorry. I thought she wanted to ask a specific question, but she said she'll wait till you're completed. So.
Okay. The second program is a pilot project that would work with the families who are participating in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is the state's welfare program. Currently, families that are participating in MFIP We do a fairly good job. Our timing's not real great, but we do a fairly good job of looking at the parents on the program and looking at potential mental health problems, substance abuse problems, or other barriers to employment. As you know, it is a work program. The focus is to get parents employed and off the program. We do not do much of anything at all to look at the children who are on the program, and the program is for the kids. You don't get on the program unless you have children. So right now, the service providers that I'm talking to would love to look more closely at the children, but simply don't have the capacity. So what this pilot program would do would be to appropriate funds through an RFP process of some sort to MFIT providers so they can look a little more closely at the kids. I envision it as something where they would get some funding to do this, hire a staff or whatever they need to do, and then offer the parents the opportunity to talk about, are you having any problems with your kid? Is there an issue that's going on that's preventing you from looking for a job, keeping a job, getting to work? And if that's the case, once again, opt-in voluntary, screening, diagnosis, follow-up assessment or treatment if necessary. And if that's a very time-consuming process, as you've heard from a parent already, the time that is taken with trying to get your kids some services, then we would look at that in the realm of their employment plan. If they're required right now to work 40 hours a week and they're simply not able to do it because the child is taking up so much time with services, then we would work that into the employment plan so they don't get sanctioned, they don't get kicked off the program, the kid gets the help, the parent is more successful, and the state is more successful. So that's the other section that I wanted to discuss, and I'll stand for any questions.
All right, Chair Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ayers, just one brief question. You said the check clinic is voluntary. What information is given to the parent to make sure that they understand that it's not a mandatory program, that they do have different options before having their child examined or looked at?
Ms. Ayers.
Madam Chair, Representative Walker, I don't know exactly what the opt-in form looks like, but it's a form that comes home with the child from the school that the parents would read that would say it's voluntary. Do you want your child to participate? I don't know exactly what the form looks like. I might be able to find a sample one.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ayers, Representative Growling, I think it'd be helpful for the committee to see that. I don't see Ms. White here, and hopefully she'll come next week when it's open to the public. Herself and some other individuals have some concerns as it relates to what type of information are given to parents, especially on individuals that may have English as a barrier for information. And so anything that you can get to us on that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, I'll see what I can find. I know Teen Screen does have its own website. I'll explore that and see what I can get for you guys.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Ayers? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Okay, and Ms. White is not here today, so we'll hopefully include her at a later time. Next, testifying on trauma-focused evidence-based practices, Abigail Gerwitz. I probably slaughtered your name, so you can come and correct me.
Yep. I'm Dr. Abigail Gerwitz.
You could just, identify yourself. Yes, that's all right. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Abigail Gerwitz. I am at the University of Minnesota, and I am with the Minnesota Child Response Center. I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Mary Jo Avendano, who is clinical director at Centro Cultural Chicano in Minneapolis. We're here representing the Minnesota Child Response Center, which is a broad university-community partnership to meet the needs of traumatized, particularly homeless and formerly homeless children. With your permission, I would like to begin with a small... not a story, it's true, of a young girl who we'll call Janice, who at the age of 5 escapes an abusive home with her mother to a domestic violence shelter. Over the past 2 years, Janice had seen continual assaults against her mother, who had been worn down by psychological, verbal, and physical, and sexual abuse. Janice's mother finally was able to escape, entered a battered women's shelter. Over several months following their entrance to the battered women's shelter, Janet had nightmares, wet her bed, and when her mother asked her to do something, would have streaming matches with her. children who are traumatized by violence carry the yoke of the violence with them and often go unidentified or worse still, misidentified as behavior problems, nervous, difficult children. Moreover, studies have indicated that far more homeless than housed children have experienced multiple traumatic events. Those include witnessing violence in the home or in the community, separation from their primary caregiver, exposure to catastrophic accidents, or acts of nature like tornadoes or hurricanes, or victims of abuse. While some children, due to strong protective factors, like effective parents, show resilience, others need help to recover from their experiences and be healthy. Studies have consistently shown that the mental health needs of homeless or formerly homeless children are much more severe than comparison housed children. These kids suffer from traumatic stress symptoms, anxiety, depression, and behavior problems. We conducted a study of 450 children living in 18 supportive housing agencies in the Twin City metro area. Of those kids, concerns were reported in behavioral, emotional, or learning issues about 15% of the birth to 4-year-olds, in 47% of the 5 to 11-year-olds, and 67% of the teens. As family homelessness increases, more children are exposed to traumatic events every day. And conversely, kids who are traumatized by domestic violence, for example, as the example I gave showed, are more likely to experience the disruptions of homelessness. Over the past two decades, we've made remarkable advances in our understanding of childhood traumatic stress. Thanks in large part to the work of a national network that focuses on meeting the psychosocial needs of traumatized children. This is the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Both prevention and treatment services are available for these kids. Our biggest challenge now is to get those services that we know work to the kids who need them. To do this, we must enhance awareness of the needs of traumatized kids, facilitate partnerships between community mental health providers and frontline grassroots agencies like shelters and supportive housing agencies. Stressed homeless families would then be able to access best practice trauma services, both prevention and treatment services, within shelters and housing agencies. Grant funding would provide an opportunity for the development of relationships between agencies to improve outcomes among homeless children and families. And it would provide for the development of an infrastructure to increase the interconnectedness between those providing best practices for traumatized kids. Ultimately, children benefit by having access to practices that work when they are at their most vulnerable. I'll just finish by letting you know what happened to Janice. Janice was very fortunate. She was in a shelter where the shelter providers recognized what was happening and managed to facilitate referral to a mental health provider. Unfortunately, that took several months, and whilst her therapy with the provider really helped protect her and really helped her on the path to recovery, that recovery could have come much sooner had there been extant services available. With your permission, I will offer my colleague, Dr. Avendano, to spend just a couple of minutes talking about treatment of traumatized children.
Could you identify yourself for the record, Doctor?
Okay. My name is Mary Jo Avendano de Vialca. And my connection with this service has been, for the last 3 years, I've been the clinical supervisor for the team, as well as the director for the mental health services at Centro Cultural Chicano. And one of the things that I would like to bring up is that homeless doesn't mean that you have to be without a house. It means that you have to live perhaps with another family or many families where you don't have any voice or you don't have any rights. And many of the families that I have worked with are families that live 2, 3, 5 families in a home because of the means and because they don't have the opportunity to get a job that is possible for them to find a place where to live. Now, the kids that we see every day are kids that can be used like yours or mine, and kids that have such extreme experiences with trauma that they cannot function daily. And if you don't get services on time, you may remember this. You have had in the past any kind of experience where you go to work and you're thinking about that. Just elevate that to the maximum exponent and just think going to school and worrying about if your mom is going to be killed or if your mom is going to be sick, and all the experiences that you live is going through your mind while you're sitting in school. Even when you're sitting here, if you're worrying about something, you know that you have to get rid of it if you would really want to pay attention and to be able to exceed in whatever you're doing. So my piece is that pretty much all of us know about trauma, and pretty much we know that we need to have services immediately. Otherwise, we grow up to be dysfunctional adults. That's my piece. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for either of our testifiers? Okay. If not, I'm sure... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we bring these testifiers up, I'm looking to sections of the bill that they're referencing, and I believe this is on page 11 at section 7 of this Article 2, and it's called the Trauma-Focused Evidence-Based Practices to Children. And I don't know if there's another part of the bill maybe that deals with this, but page 11, line 19, it talks about this was made into law here that these groups would be eligible to apply for grants. And I'm just wondering what the status is now, what you do to apply for grants, or what would be different if this law was signed into law here?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. This would provide the infrastructure that doesn't currently exist. It would build the capacity of shelters to identify and partner with local mental health and social service providers. Right now, accessing services through shelters is pretty much on a catch-as-catch-can basis, and also depends on children having health insurance to be able to reimburse for those services. In some cases, agencies are lucky enough to have access to county funds, for example, that cover uninsured children, but that's very much on a catch-as-catch-can basis. Hope that answers.
If I may add, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is a specialized therapy that it has already proven exit success when you do it with children that have experienced trauma. And this is a training that is available only if you can pay for it. Not many therapists can have those resources to learn about the treatment. And it would be great if we can disseminate information so more therapists know how to deal with trauma in the aspect of children.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gerwitz, you mentioned infrastructure that doesn't exist, but this would help make that happen. Do you know of somewhere else in the states that has this already in place, infrastructure?
Yes, I do. California has a pretty well-developed system to provide help for traumatized homeless children. The Homeless Children's Provider Network in San Francisco is, I think, an excellent example.
Thank you, Doctor. Yes, Representative.
Dr. Gerwitz, how extensive is that program that California has? Are you aware of what all is included in that?
It started as a pretty small program to match mental health providers with children in homeless shelters, and it has grown extensively since. I can't tell you how large it is now. Several years ago when I was in contact with the program, the funding was about $250,000 to
$300,000 a year. Thank you, Doctor. Have a follow-up? Okay. And are there any other questions for our presenters? If not, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And then a past testifier, Carol White, I believe has come. So, Carol, if you'd like to come forward and testify at this time, we're a little bit past your place on the agenda, so I don't know if you'd... If you don't want to testify at this time, that's fine. We'll, okay, all right. Well, Okay, we'll continue with the testimony to culturally competent care. Angie Stratic, if you'd come to the microphone. I did all right on your name. Thank you. And identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Angie Stratic. You did very well.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angie Stratig. I'm an enrolled member of the Lake Manitoba Band of Ojibwe and a mental health professional at the American Indian Family Center in St. Paul. The American Indian Family Center provides culturally specific mental health services along with other health-related services. I am also a member of a committee of culturally specific providers who are working hard to meet the mental health needs of people in our communities. In mental health care, like regular health care, disparity is a huge concern in Minnesota and across the nation. The rate of attempted suicide is greater among Latino youth than white, 10.7%. Yet less than 1 in 11 contact mental health care facilities and less than 1 in 5 contact general health care providers for treatment. In the Asian American community, there's a great deal of shame and embarrassment related to mental illness. One study found that only 17% of those experiencing symptoms seek care. In the African American community, the percentage of African Americans receiving treatment from any source was only about half of that of whites. Most African Americans who received care relied on the safety net of public sector programs. Language, stigma, lack of insurance are key barriers in all communities of color. But even more so is the lack of culturally specific providers. These providers are important in that they have trusting relationships in the community and understand the cultural implications of how mental illness is viewed and treated. In the American Indian community, the impact of mental illness is devastating. Social policies of the past, such as out-of-culture adoptions, the brutal boarding schools, relocations to reservations, to name a few, attempted to destroy our cultural ways by means of assimilating our community into dominant culture. These policies of the past continue to affect our community today. Only a generation or two later, our community experiences significantly higher rates of poverty, unemployment, violence, and substance abuse. Suicide is 190% higher in our Native communities than for whites. Health disparities such as diabetes, alcohol abuse, heart disease, and infant mortality are much higher in our community and our life expectancy a lot lower. Our youth have higher rates of mental illness, including substance abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and suicidal thoughts. All of this contributes to a life where you hear of tragic occurrences way too frequently and often in our own families. Even still, the American Indian community still survives, is resilient and strong because of our cultural ways. For example, a recent study by Arlene Stiffman from Washington University recognized the importance of traditional healers in American Indian communities and their use of prayer, native medicine, and ceremonies. The study found that traditional healers offered services to youth that were very similar to those of professional providers, including referrals, counseling, and family resources, as well as their unique traditional healing. The study also found that the youth who reported higher levels of cultural and spiritual involvement in American Indian culture were more likely to use traditional providers. Traditional healers reported that they were firmly embedded in the larger mental health service system and referral network, with health and education, inpatient mental health services, outpatient health services, and other non-traditional services. Results revealed that traditional healers offer traditional medicine to almost all the youth they served, but traditional healers also offered youth many of the same services offered by professional providers such as counseling, referrals, and family resources. Traditional healers form collaborative relationships with other providers on behalf of youth with a variety of mental health and behavioral problems. There are two sections of the bill that is before you today that are important to help address the disparities in our communities. The first is the Loan Forgiveness Program,
in order to receive medical assistance dollars, our programs need to have licensed mental health care professionals. It can be very difficult to find someone of our culture who has these credentials, and even when we do, it's only a matter of time before we lose them to the county or state who can offer them more money and benefits. The second part of the bill is grant funds that will enable our culturally specific organizations to bridge the gap between the traditional mental health providers in our communities and to provide culturally specific support services. On behalf of our children who need access to services to be successful in school, home, and the community, I urge you to support these sections of the bill. Too often our children are placed in foster care, end up in the juvenile justice system, or worse, because we have not been able to address their mental health needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Are there questions for Ms. Stradic? Thank you very much for that testimony. And with your personal connection to those issues and the cultural differences, I think, are something we have to pay careful attention to in all the issues we address as a legislature. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Ahmad Youssef is our next testifier. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Colleen McDonald. I work at the Community University Healthcare Center in Ahmed Youssef, and I will be tag-teaming today to provide this presentation.
All right, great.
I'll just give a brief intro, and then Ahmed will give you some stories about some of the work that we do at the clinic. The Community University Healthcare Center is a community clinic that receives funding actually from the Minnesota Department of Human Services around Somali mental health services. We're one of the first few Somali mental health providers in the county, and we serve people, again, from around the county, but also we do get a lot of calls for assistance in trying to help be the bridge between traditional services and social services. So I just wanted to thank Angie again for her testimony as well, because a lot of what she was saying we see in the different communities that we serve. We serve about 2,400 people a year, and we provide services in 7 languages. About 70% of people who come to our clinic are people of color, immigrants, or refugees. And I think we started in the 90s around starting our Somali mental health program, and so Ahmed has been one of our case managers since day one, so he is here to offer some stories. So, here you go.
Thank you. My name is, again, Ahmed Youssef, and thanks for the opportunity, Madam Chair, as well as the members of the committee. I'm just trying briefly to touch on, not going to give you anecdotes of all of those, but I'm just going to give you just a pro data, maybe a case and in the field of what I face when I'm there. For example, I can actually specifically tell you about a particular case, a client of mine who is not actually a Somali. Most of my clients happen to be Somali. But there are Iskandar, Eritrean, Ethiopian, and there is a Sudanese. The guy that I am most attached to is from Sudan, southern Sudan. And though that I don't speak his language, and actually we speak in Somali, there is some kind of a cultural affinity between us. That client has, or actually had tried to commit suicide twice. Most of when he is psychotic, he shows his symptoms that no one, except someone that who is somewhat fierce or someone that who is knowledgeable about his culture, will know. Those symptoms are sometimes someone that who doesn't know are frightening, and he's 6'4", 6'4", very imposing guy, doesn't talk most of the time, gets mute. So at times when you call the police, it is a real threat there. And one particular day, I mean, he was a psychotic, and the police were in the facility, and he was just exactly standing like this. And as a matter of fact, what he was just trying to do was just exactly to shake someone's hand. And this is a respect someone that you actually respect. So he realized there's a police coming. And he was just exactly trying to be ready for them. And if I didn't get there in time, possibly he would have been shot. Well, because this is an imposing 6'4 guy that is just exactly standing and as though he's just holding a gun. So the issues, cultural issues actually are very is it necessary sometimes to know, and there is always, you gotta have someone that who is able to bridge that gap between the dominant culture as well as this, that little small diversion that is actually just coming on and adding on to the dominant culture. I'm not going to explain anything else. It's just that I will leave you to the interpretation of whatever that means, but that's my life.
Let me just give one caveat. That's definitely a composite story of some of the clients that Ahmed's been working with. But one thing I should mention that Ahmed did is, again, with somebody who is often mental illness is attached to a lot of stigma, and so people within their culture become stigmatized and very isolated because, people are seen as being, quote-unquote, crazy. There's no, in different cultures, there's not an idea of a spectrum that people can manage mental illness or be part of the community and manage mental illness. So one thing that Ahmed did particularly with this case is he developed a whole team of people, a doctor, the landlord,
PCA,
all the different folks who could kind of come and intervene whenever they noticed this person was seeming to have problems and maybe not on their medication anymore. And so, again, he was able to develop the relationship with this client and also work with this team to make sure that the care that he was being monitored. And so that has prevented other episodes that this person has had. So the person has been able to be in the community and be integrated in the community. Another piece of what Ahmed does a lot, and I'm speaking because, when you're actually doing the work, it's hard to sometimes remember all that you're doing. So I'm just saying, Ahmed spends a lot of time educating families, again, around the importance of mental illness and how it can be treated and how they can also contribute in supporting the recovery and healing and management. So, again, that's a lot of work that our Somali team has been doing for a number of years, is reducing stigma, building family support capacity, and also, engaging in a discussion across the community level around mental illness, and again, that it can be treated and it can be managed. So.
Thank you. Chair Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question for the testifiers. Just thank you, Representative Greiling, and the network for putting this part in. Sometimes we get confused with culturally competent care with diversity training, and it's a totally two different, distinct things. And communities of color in general, I'll speak specifically for the African-American community, do not have a positive history with any form of treatment nor being diagnosed with some form of mental health issue, whether it is the Tuskegee Institute situation or even recently in the 70s with individuals being diagnosed with schizophrenia that should not have been. There's so many mixed feelings. I think about my own family who's educated, understands that individuals have difficulties, and I remember when I decided to take my son for grief counseling after his two grandfathers had died and his father moved out of state. And the flack that I got from the members of my family, because it wasn't something that you did, you handled it within. Grief, depression is something that you suck up. You talk as amongst the family and you move on because you have to get up and move on and go to school or to work. And then individuals that, as Representative Brown said earlier, that don't have the chance of being diagnosed because of the stigma and the fear. And then, because so many individuals have been overdiagnosed or misdiagnosed, and trying to find that balance in the middle, I believe culturally competent care will help us do that, working with not just the family but the community along this part
being able to have professionals, and throughout the state, if we're not able to have specific individuals of color that are able to work with members that of the community that are color, if we can have real trained other individuals that have the true competence of care and understanding how to network. If you're in Bemidji and you're trying to work with an individual, a 10-year-old African-American girl who used to be from South Minneapolis and is up there now because she's in foster care, how you connect with that one of the African-American organizations in South Minneapolis to make sure that you have resources to do what you're supposed to do for that 10-year-old girl is really important. So I thank you for this piece.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McDonald, the Somali population that you service at the clinic, how many are there, and how many would you say are in a situation that, as Ahmed says, maybe have some diagnosis of mental illness or things like that?
Ms. McDonald.
Our total clinic population is about 9,000, and so I'd say in our total clinic population we have at least 1,500 Somali folks who are coming for medical, dental, and mental health. Our Somali mental health program is one of our largest programs. We have, I think, 4 case managers currently, and they work, again, in teams with our clinical nurse specialists and our psychiatry staff and our therapists. I'm guessing, I'm trying to remember offhand what the number was. Do you know the numbers on that?
It's about, actually, I think the case management people that were particularly with serious and mental illness are about 140, and actually 140
current cases.
Yes, current cases.
And I think we've done at least 1,000 over the last few years. I mean, if you're looking at all of the years that we've been providing that service.
Yeah, and it's a bit actually proportionally, if you look at proportionality, it's not done yet, or actually as far as we know. But Somalis are actually getting mentally ill in terms of proportionality more than any ethnic group that we accept.
We're seeing acute cases of mental illness, like post-traumatic stress disorder and other things, because of the war and the trauma. So we see a lot of acute issues with our older immigrant refugee populations. With our Hmong populations, we're seeing an older group of people who have not been able to acculturate and are still have extreme mental illness. And so we're serving a different population for our older immigrant and refugee groups, but our Somalis are a newer population and coming with newer, more acute care needs. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, you're welcome. Other questions, comments? Yes. Representative Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you for your work. Your clinic is really a leader in our state, and many of us look to you as a resource, and as our population has changed over the years in Minnesota, it has presented challenges, and really grateful for your services. We're also very lucky to have the Center for Victims of Torture as well. And a lot of, I think, it's amazing the lack of understanding, I think, that people who are in the healthcare system, who are providing the services, have about the populations that we serve. And, you know, as a provider, when the doors close, you have the privilege to hear the stories, mm-hmm. and they're quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to thank you for your work.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. If there are no further comments or questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, we move to suicide prevention, colleges, and coverage issues. Will Wilson is our first testifier. If you'd come to the podium, please, Will, and identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association. A couple of things. I'd like to thank Representative Greiland. This is it's an exciting year for mental health, and we appreciate your leadership on this issue this year. Also, as was mentioned before, the Mental Health Association and NAMI co-chair the legislative network, and I would like to take this time to thank Sue Abbott. She has the baton this year, and I think she's already run a marathon, so thanks. I'm here to talk, along with the rest of the testifiers, about the last 3 lines of the bill. It's about suicide prevention grants, and this language is also represented, just briefly, just wanted to mention, it's also House File. You can hear me. I apologize. This is also House File 315, which Representative Otremba is offering, and that's going to be heard Wednesday in Karen Clark's committee, Representative Clark's committee. Also wanted to say one more thing. It sounds like Rachel Schott from Yellow Ribbon is not going to be able to make it. She was going to try to drive up from Mankato, but I heard she had to take her child to the hospital, I think. So hopefully everything's okay.
Thank you for letting us know that.
In Minnesota, there are four times as many deaths by suicide as there are by homicide. It's a problem that I think everybody in this room probably knows someone, probably knows a family who's been affected by it. It's a problem that is with us and that we need to address. And the language in this bill that would fund the suicide prevention grants within the Department of Health has kind of a long legislative history that speaks perhaps more to the than the three lines would indicate. First of all, in 2000, the Department of Health issued a report about suicide prevention, and which called for increases in grants that would go to community-based grants for evidence-based efforts to prevent suicide. So in 2001, the legislature did agree that this was a priority, and the legislature allocated about $1.1 million a year to suicide prevention grants that went around the state that covered culturally and geographically specific efforts to prevent suicide. After that, I think everybody in the room is aware that we had some difficult budgetary years and some decisions were made. They were cut originally in 2003, and then in 2005 these grants were eliminated. So at the moment, the state commitment to suicide prevention grants is $0. And we are asking to restore the $1.1 million, which would be the high watermark of funding as it was in 2001. And with that, I think I'm just going to pass it off to Dr. Dan Rydenberg, who's here from SAVE, to talk about some grantees and efforts around the state.
Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you.
Will, you could maybe stay up there with Dr. Rydenberg in case there are questions that are appropriate for you to respond to after Dr. Rydenberg's testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and the representative for sponsoring the bill, and also the members of the Department of Health who are here today, who are great partners with us in this effort. My name is Dr. Dan Rydenberg, and I'm the Executive Director of SAVE. I'm also the Managing Director of the National Council for Suicide Prevention, so I bring to you both a statewide and a national perspective on this issue. SAVE is a national nonprofit organization with a mission to prevent suicide. We represent clinicians, researchers, and advocates, but we also speak for the thousands of Minnesota constituents, many of them whom are survivors. Parents and siblings, coworkers, and neighbors who have lost a loved one to suicide. We speak to you intimately knowing about suicide and what it is like to live as a survivor. With suicide being the third leading cause of death for our youth in this state, with more than 500 suicides a year in this state, and an estimated 3,000 to 12,000 suicide attempts annually in this state, we must do everything we can to raise awareness, educate, and help those in need to prevent unnecessary loss of life. We know that local communities must take more responsibility for suicide prevention because state government cannot do it alone. We also understand that government spending must be held down. However, some spending on a life and death issue is necessary. Suicide is a public health issue that deserves and needs government involvement and should be in the state budget. State and federal involvement in this issue has repeatedly been recommended by the United States Surgeon General, the President's New Freedom Commission, and Healthy People 2010. Suicide is a complex and multifaceted public health issue. That said, research has documented that mental disorders are involved in 90% of suicides. Depression and the depressive phase of a bipolar disorder have been found in an average of 60% of suicides. Research has consistently found that psychotherapy combined with medication is the most effective treatment for depression and consequently for preventing suicide. However, work must be done to raise awareness of the warning signs and symptoms of these issues so that we can get people into the life-saving treatments that are available. As survivors and experts in suicide, we implore you to find and fund suicide prevention efforts for Minnesota. In this state, for every suicide, the average work loss cost for every suicide in 2001 was staggering, $1,209,911. Minnesota hospital charges for suicide attempts increased from $28 million in 2001 to over $48.2 million in 2004. Over the last 5 years, there's been a steady increase in suicide in this state. These are alarming trends that need your attention. Funding for raising awareness, education, training, and technical assistance are just a few of the major issues we would like to continue working on collaboratively with the Department of Health. All we need is your financial support. You have the power to save lives for this and for future generations in renewing the Suicide Prevention Grants Program. If you knew that your son or daughter, husband or wife, were suffering from a treatable medical disease, but they were afraid to seek treatment or didn't know treatment was available, and their illness got worse to the point of suicide, how would you feel? Please help us make it easier, not more difficult, to get this information to our citizens, and in turn, you will save lives. Thank you.
Are there questions for either Mr. Wilson or Dr. Reidenberg? Yes, Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, you mentioned about specifically this $1.1 million a year on the last page here, page 46, which deals with the Department of Health, and it doesn't look like there's any kind of age parameters in that. I'm also looking on page 24 of the bill, page 24, lines 3 through 6, which specifically talks about the Commissioner of Human Services for grants to institutions of higher education, and the wording is slightly different. Your area talked about suicide prevention program. Page 24 talks about early intervention and prevention strategies. I'm wondering, do these two programs work together? What's the difference? Why can't it all be in one department? Maybe if you could give us a little more detail on that.
Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair and Representative Tingelstad, I think some of the difference in this is that the funding that would go to the Department of Health would be under the Family Services Grants, and that's a program that existed until 2005. And we're asking just for a recommitment of that funding. And I believe that the language on page 24 is to fund Teen Screen, which is a school-based program. That isn't it?
No.
I'm sorry.
A little conference occurring here so we can get the correct perspective. Okay. Ms. Aberholden?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This was actually an idea from Senator Marty, who's the Senate author of the bill. On the federal level, there was money available for colleges to really implement strategies within their universities and colleges to prevent suicide. As you know, that is an issue on college campuses. And because there weren't a lot of federal dollars out there, Senator Marty thought it would be appropriate to do a similar program in Minnesota targeted at the colleges and universities. So they are two separate programs with two separate dollars.
Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to follow up then, I'm wondering how much these programs would work together. I just want to make sure we're not doubling up on things here.
Ms. Aberholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Tingelstad, I believe they'd be complementary. There are best practices out there that, you know, kind of everybody uses in terms of gatekeeping and things of that sort. It would just be targeted a little bit more and integrated on a campus.
Any other questions for our presenters? Now we have one last testifier, Al Klusner. If you'd come to the podium and identify yourself, and welcome.
Yeah. I have an assistant.
It's good to have an assistant. I realize that.
Yes, I'm Al Klusner. I'm a concerned parent, not a lobbyist, although I may look like one. I was involved in the first suicide. Al Klusner, I'm a co-founder of SAVE, along with my wife and along with two or three other couples. And we founded that organization, I think it was in 88. We lost two children to suicide. Our daughter Amy at 21 in 1985, who was a 3-9 student at Iowa State University. And our son Michael in 1997, age 38, who was at one time a Merrill Lynch consultant, but he had bipolar and he suicided. And after those happened, we truly got on this project. I want to show you two slides. Can you see that, guys? After a Reno conference in 1998, where the Surgeon General said, suicide is a public health problem. It's not a behavioral problem. After that was established, it was suggested that the various states analyze this problem. This took from 1998 to 2000 to get this report out. There were probably 70 to 80 people involved with speakers from all across the country to give us the input. And of course, frequently, as we all know, there are many areas where you study the problem, but what do you do next? The report goes on the deal. So, in a very vigorous way, we pressed the state of Minnesota to fund a suicide prevention bill, which did happen. And I might point out, under Jesse Ventura's period, where he talked about suicide people were cowards, but he signed the bill because it made a lot of sense. And that bill was, because it's a health issue, did go over to the Department of Health. And the Department of Health went into all the counties and asked for grants for that $1 million that year. And I think they issued something like 13 or 14 grants to various cultures in various different areas. But the beauty about it, it was the Paul Wellstrom bit. You've got to get out to the people. You know, we have a lot of, and he said, yeah, you have to, and that was the idea. And they did a tremendous job. Now, what happened is that when we had a change of regime as it relates to the administration and our government, there were other things that were going on very positively across the nation in suicide prevention. The Gordon Smith bill, the senator out of Oregon lost his son, and there was a $60 million, I think maybe a little bit more, came forth. Well, our people in the Department of Health and the administration in this state says, well, the money is going to come there. We don't need this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I argued, but of course lost the argument, that is for a different area. And as Sue mentioned earlier, a lot of that went into colleges, and this was a different program. We were community-based. We were out in the communities. Department of Health did a terrific job. Now, one more slide, and then I'll stop. I'd like you to look at this chart. This chart shows you the Minnesota deaths. In 1992, we had five. This comes directly from the Department of Health epidemiologists. John Rossler, I believe his name is. I know it is because I meet with him often. Suicide in 1992 were 511. And we moved down the scale and we actually hit a low of 488. About 6-8 months ago, I recognized it was 529. Now, the Amys do not have to die. As was presented by Dr. Reitenberg, these people have a brain disease that can be treated. And exactly where we were a couple of years ago we were doing that. But in the wisdom in the corner office of this state, they threw it out. Simultaneously, we did not permeate the state, I think appropriately, my thoughts, as it relates to awareness. We were talking to doctors and universities, but we're not talking to people in bowling alleys and in the Holiday Inns, and as was rightly pointed out, on the Indian reservations. I used to go to Indian reservations, and that is where it is really, really high. There's no question about it. So what happened, and which got me alarmed, of course, is that we go from 511, a high, with a low of 488, and in 2004 it was 529. That does not, 529, that does not have to happen. And I believe that the two, that the 1.1 million out of our, I don't know, $40 billion stuff here in this state should be reinstated. And the big question is, should it be health or human services? And human services have a much broader network, but it is a health issue. It's not a behavior issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kusner. Are there any questions from representatives, closing comments? Because Rachel Schott wasn't able to be here today, I'd just like to take a moment to comment on the Yellow Ribbon Program, because Rachel is a Mankato resident, and she and her family became involved in suicide prevention because her younger brother, Aaron, committed suicide. He was a classmate of my daughter's. There was a cluster of young males, high school boys, who committed suicide in the mid-90s, and the Yellow Ribbon Program grew out of that in our area and has been very successful, most of all in making the subject, opening the discussion among high school students about the subject so that it's not a taboo subject, and that they there's been a lot of work to have high school students help one another and speak out for each other, and the whole program involves a little card that you can give to someone if you need help and you stay with a friend or see that they get help. But anyway, it's been very successful in our region and is widely supported, and had grant dollars until recently, and now they're struggling very much to survive. So it's just another example of the type of programming. If there are no further comments,
Madam Chair,
yes.
To that point, the Yellow Ribbon Program, which is very effective, was a direct recipient of some of these funds. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. If there are no further questions or comments, Representative Greiling, would you have any closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think Mr. Klusner was a good ending, so I'm just going to leave it at that, and thank you all very much for your attention, and look forward to continuing next week.
All right. Before we adjourn, I'll move to lay over House File 196, and the meeting is adjourned.